Welcome to our penultimate HO research seminar for this term, and it's a great pleasure to actually introduce one of our own. If I could say to introduce today's seminar, Dr. Anna Tutoglou is our National Bank of Greece postdoctoral fellow. She's with us for this whole academic year, and as you can see, she's working on something which is highly topical. And very relevant in a variety of different ways. The title of her talk reflects this, Beyond Crisis, Constitutional Change in Greece After the Memoranda. Anna has a very packed CV, considering she's in a sense at the beginning of her academic career. She's got a PhD from the University of Athens, and she came to us from Princeton University, where she was a postdoctoral research fellow. She's published in Greek, Public Security and Privacy, and she's currently working on a book project which she started before she came to us, which she started in Princeton, and I think reflects some of the ideas which she'll be sharing with us this evening. So she's very, very well placed to talk about the constitutional change that may or may not occur in Greece in time of crisis, and I'd like to welcome you to this evening's seminar, Anna.
Thank you, Spiros. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Bank of Greece, for funding my
National Bank of Greece.
National Bank of Greece for funding this year of mine, for honoring me for this with this fellowship, and for hosting me in this vibrant place. I think the LSE was—it's much better than I had expected. And thank all of you for coming tonight. As Spiro said, this is a project I started last year in the States. But the original idea, I should say—was actually born in Florence when I was a visiting PhD student back in 2012, and. I was lucky to attend a workshop on the euro crisis and institutional change, which sort of triggered me to think more about my subject and to find a language to describe of what is going on in Greece and either other crisis hit states. So tonight, I'm going to talk about the idea of constitutional change, which are the drivers of constitutional change in a state, and not just a crisis state, but any state. In the case of Greece, I will have three axes to describe my topic. The first will be the parliament versus the troika, and whatever distortions that brings to the parliament. The second axis will be the courts, the judicial distortions and the judicial asymmetries that we face in the crisis. And the third axis will be the people. And by the people, I will talk about how the plebiscites of 2015 play out in the dynamics of the crisis. And I will try to draw some comparisons with the Brexit referendum, and finally, I will close my talk with what's the way forward for Greece. But before I talk about Greece, and considering the fact that I appeal to a non-legal audience, with few exceptions, I will try to ask the question to answer the questions: what is a constitution? How constitutions change, who drives constitutional change, and whether crisis can bring constitutional change. So the constitution is basically a document. It's the supreme law of a country. It encompasses a set of principles according to which the state is governed. Most famous principle is the separation of powers. Usually, constitutions may contain a Bill of Rights. The Greek one does. It can be written, that is codified, or it can be not written. Most famous example is the British Constitution, which is not written. Constitutions can be short. For example, the US Constitution is only 7,000 words long. whereas the Greek one is 27,000 words long, and the Indian is the worst, 147,000 words. The Constitution is a text that is interpreted through the political process, the parliament, and it's applied, the executive, and particularly by the courts through the case law. When we say about review of constitutionality, there are various ways this can happen. The most usual way is through constitutional courts, that is specialized central courts. We have a centralized system of judicial review of constitutionality. States that have adopted this system is Germany, Italy, Portugal, etc. And it can be diffused, like in America, and Greece has followed the American model too. So in that sense, every court in Greece, from the lowest to the highest, can review constitutionality.
I don't think you say that the US also has centralized the Supreme Court.
No, it's diffuse. I will talk about the Supreme Court. So the American Constitution, which you see here, is the oldest, the longest surviving, and as I said, one of the shortest ones. And it dates from 1789, when it was adopted at the Philadelphia Convention. And imagine, since 1789, it has stayed, it has been amended 27 times. The most famous amendments is the Bill of Rights, which is the first 10 amendments. And it has evolved through the constitutional interpretation of the Supreme Court, particularly in the field of human rights. So imagine when the American Constitution was drafted in 1789, the founding fathers had no idea about gay marriage, civil rights, etc. Even slavery, that was that came after. Imagine the power of a court that interprets the Constitution for in parallel with an evolving nation. And here we have the Greek Constitution, and the current one dates from 1975. So that is, it was it was adopted after the fall of the military dictatorship. And since 1975, in 40 years, it has been amended three times. The most serious amendments were in 86, and especially in 2001, that was the broadest. 2008 was sort of minor. And now, since last year, the current, the present government has initiated the procedure to amend it again, but we'll see how the consensus develops. So, how constitutions change. There are two ways to change a constitution. One is a formal one, through the revision, the one I just mentioned before. That's the de jure, according to the law. But there are some setbacks here, because sometimes it can be a very long and very difficult process. It may require a strong political consensus, and sometimes it needs qualified majorities, but that depends on what the Constitution itself provides. It can be rigid or flexible. The other way a Constitution may change is through practice. And when I say through practice, through the practice of the state institutions. Informal de facto practice, which I shall focus today on my talk, tends to happen in states that have usually more rigid constitutions. That is, that states that where procedures to amend the constitution are rather difficult. And then we have the question of whether practice, this kind of institutional practice, is can be normalized, so the temporary becomes permanent. In Greece, the constitution is rather difficult to change, because according to Article 10, you need to have two parliaments to agree on this. that are in the first case you need a three-fifths majority of the total number of members to approve a proposal in two ballots, and then in the next parliament you need an absolute majority. And the strictest factor here is the time limitation, that you need 5 years before the next revision. So, who drives the change? Here we have an interplay. Within a state, we have the parliament that enacts laws. We have the executive that produces acts, the courts that produce case law, and the people that can initiate a change through the referendum. But on the same side, we have on the other side, we have the external players that can be supranational institutions like the European Union, or you can have ad hoc institutions like the Troika, which is now being converted into a quartet with the addition of the ESM. Let us keep in mind that Greece has been a member of the European Union since the 1980s, and as such, it belongs to the shared sovereignty era. That is, many powers that had traditionally been vested in national institutions have been delegated to supranational institutions. And this is, we could say, this is this happens because we live in the age of interdependence of states, interconnectedness and interdependence of states and institutions. The question I'm raising is whether crisis can serve as constitutional moments. And as such, I'm referring to the theory of Bruce Ackerman, Yale Law School professor, who has written some exceptional books on constitutional change. And what is a constitutional moment? It's, as he calls it, extraordinary moments in a nation's history of intense constitutional deliberation that may result in constitutional transformations. But that, if you think about it, the crisis cannot be a moment. What we see in Greece, it has been going on for over 7 years. And as I say in my slide, the Greek case is very sui generis because the institutional crisis predated the sovereign debt and the euro crisis. The other question I'm raising is whether how this crisis narrative affects our perception of the Constitution, because as we will see, the crisis has been used to normalize exceptional measures, to justify things that wouldn't happen otherwise, and most importantly, it has changed our perception of the Constitution. It has brought a new ethos to the Constitution, where the Constitution as a document stays as it is, as a facade, but the substance keeps changing. So constitutional change in Greece. I'll come to my first axis, that is the Parliament versus the Troika. This nice image is from a very talented artist from a major daily newspaper, Kathmirini. And here you can see Angela Merkel speaking to Wolfgang Schäuble. That was back 2 years ago, and that's when they started calling the Troika as the new institutions, the extension as a breach, and the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, as a contract, and Samaras Tsipras. So you see the words start changing and they mean something else. So, separation of powers. In Greece, legislative powers are vested in the parliament. Executive powers are exercised by the president, primarily the government, because the president merely signs whatever the government gives him. And the judicial powers should be exercised by courts of law. Now, this new thing, the MOUs, which we keep hearing, the memoranda and the memoranda, etc., etc., they're merely political agreements. They are not, as I will say later, they do not have, they're not legally binding. So they are agreements on the basis of which Greece and other crisis hit states agree to bailouts, the bailouts terms. And with these bailouts, the countries want to restore their fiscal balance and growth. So in Greece, we've had three MOUs over 7 years in exchange for loans, and we're talking about over 300 billion euros of fiscal aid. There are rumors of a third.
You take the question now, do you want to wait till the end?
It's short. I remember the first case about constitutionality, when the court, the Symbolic Superior, saying these are neither legal nor political agreements, but technical frameworks of cooperation. So I have the impression that memoranda are not political in the sense of sovereign countries coming together, but
They said that, I will come to that decision later, they said that they are not international agreements, which has other consequences. Yeah. But I'll come back to that later.
Let's Ioana, go. If you, we'll take your question afterwards, okay? Otherwise, I think it's going to be... Do you want to take it now?
Okay, if it's short, yes.
I'm pretty sure there are annexes to the loan agreements that Greece signed as a legal, as a sovereign legal person with the international creditors. There are loan facility agreements for all this lending to which the memorandum of understanding are annexed, and as a result they are legally binding documents to the extent that Greece wants to draw or needs to draw under those facilities. They are acts that, you know, that the Conseil d'Etat in this case issued legal opinions. They are legally binding in the sense that they are attached to the loan agreements, which are legally binding contracts that produce legal obligations.
Okay. You can answer later if you want.
Yes, okay. When I come to the decision of the Council of State. Let me just say that these MOUs have been signed by three different governments, both on the right and on the left side of the political spectrum. But despite this fact, there has not been political consensus on the bailouts, and there has not been consensus on the citizen side. They have been drafted by the creditors and agreed by the governments. The imposed conditionality, that is, conditions upon which the money was given to Greece. But the legality, as I just said, and the justiciability of the MOUs has been disputed. Particularly, the Council of State has ruled that they are not international treaties, because if they were, they would have to be ratified by the Parliament by qualified majorities. And the MOUs are implemented into Greek law through the austerity package laws. They impose fast-track fiscal adjustment. And the downside is that often they set unrealistic targets that Greece has failed to deliver in such little time frames, and that can be attributed partially to the already weak state institutions. Let me come to the normal way that Parliament operates in Greece. Every bill, the initiative, the right to introduce bill, normally belongs to the Parliament and the government. every bill normally should not contain provisions that are irrelevant to the law. And that goes, it goes the same for the amendments that are proposed. Also, normally every bill has to be debated according to Article 6 on once in principle by article and as a whole, twice in two distinct settings, etc. There is an exception, that paragraph 4, that says a bill or law proposal designated as very urgent shall be introduced after a limited debate in one sitting. How does the Parliament actually work? This previous provision that I just read has been steadily abused to pass many, many laws, and I'm not going to start the list of these laws, but that has been has become the normal procedure to pass laws after the MOUs. And the condition of the very urgent nature is not always satisfied, because the rationale is that the Parliament works not to you know, to deliberate laws, but it works to satisfy whatever the Troika decides as a deadline. So we have the normalization of the emergency procedure, emergency legislation. As you can imagine, this has a direct impact on the quality of the legislation, because when you pass laws that are 200 pages long and you have only one sitting that may last until 3 a.m. in the morning, and many MPs acknowledge, like I can remember MP Chrysochoidis, who said, I'm sorry, but I had other things to do. I did not have the time to read the MOU. So you can imagine how these very severe laws have been passed in Greece. No time for deliberations. Also, another phenomenon is that governments have steadily promoted proposals or amendments that contain provisions, as I said before, that are totally unrelated to the main subject of the proposal. And here I mention former Justice Minister Nikos Paraskevopoulos, who last year, during the discussion about some law, said we should be rather lax when we apply the Constitution. And sometimes you can have a law that can have 20 articles, and you may have 50 amendments, and they are submitted 5 minutes before the deadline. So this this has become the normal procedure. Another phenomenon is the so-called praxis nomothetikou perichomenou, that which is translated as the legislative decrees. Normally, this is a procedure that should be applied only in extraordinary circumstances of an urgent and unforeseeable need. The cabinet makes a proposal, that is the government, and the president of the republic just signs, and they become law. And then they have to be submitted to the parliament within 40 days of their issuance, or within 40 days from the convocation of a parliamentary session. But as I'm underlining here, this is a procedure that should be followed only in extraordinary circumstances. Now, during the past 6 or 7 years, as you will see in the next slide, there has been a steady rise and a steady abuse of this exceptional provision. And this this happened because the government found a way to bypass the parliament. It happens that often the condition of extraordinary circumstances is totally absent. And the worst thing is that this condition cannot be reviewed by the courts, because the courts steadily, with case law that dates back to the 80s, say that this is a political question and courts cannot review this condition. As you understand, this fact totally disturbs the separation of powers, and the worst is that it leaves the executive to act unbound. And the recent legal theory basically promotes that we should revisit this case law and our theories about the praxis nomothetikou perichomenou and establish the possibility that courts should be able to review this. Now, this is a very interesting graph that I took from a report of the ANEOS's report, Polynomia, Kakonomia, Graphiokratia, στην Ελλάδα, that shows how the legislative decrees have developed during the past 15 years. As you can see, the steady rise starts from 2010 or 11. That's when Greece got its first bailout. And then steadily goes up and down. So if you add all these, you can have more than 80 legislative decrees in 70 years, whereas in the past few years, you had less than 10. And this has been abused by more recent governments, the Samaras government and the Tsipras government, which the Tsipras government, as you will see in the second slide, before they became government, said things like the disgrace of PMPs does not exist in any other country. PMPs are junta-inspired, and PMPs are a distortion of our polity. But that was, again, as I say, before they became government. Now, let's turn to the courts. Another image from Kathimerini. The woman in the middle is Vasiliki Thanou. She's the current president of the Arios Pagos, which is the high court that has jurisdiction on civil and criminal matters. And she has become a very prominent figure in in Greek politics because somehow she has some radical ideas of how the constitution should be interpreted. And basically this image mocks her. She says, okay, let's set up the agenda for the next Arios Pagos meeting and question whether the Gregorian calendar is constitutional or not. That is, to discuss whether things should stand as they have to. Now, the thing is that justices in Greece have become a state within a state, and I will explain why in the next slide. First of all, I should say that according to Article 87, judges enjoy functional and personal independence. That is, they should be free to exercise their duties without being dependent on any interests. A condition for this independence is their remuneration. That is, they should have a sufficient salary to perform the duties that should be commensurate with their office. And also, Article 88, paragraph 5, says that the retirement shall be compulsory when they attain the age of 65, that is for appellate judges or lower judges, and for high court judges when they attain the age of 67. If you read those clauses, the Constitution does not say anything about salary cuts. That is, salary cuts can be constitutional. The Constitution also does not provide for any specific ranks, levels. But what it does provide is a compulsory retirement age. Now, I'm saying this because lately there have been talks initiated by Mrs. Thanu that you saw before that the judges should interpret the constitution differently and go contra legem, that is, or should I say contra constitutionem, against the constitution, and retire in the age of 70 or 75, I don't remember. And of course you can understand what kind of reactions this has sparked in Greek politics, including by the judges themselves. but let's stick to the salary thing. Since the revision of 2001, there has been a new court, a special court, the Misodikio, that has the jurisdiction to decide on all matters related to judges' compensation and judges' pension. This is a court, but substantially it's not a court in the traditional sense, because it is composed by three judges, three law professors, and three lawyers. And this composition is by lottery, and it changes every year. Now, the law professors and the lawyers who are, and I'm saying the law professors too, because many of the law professors exercise law as practicing attorneys too, they tend to side with the judges. You may imagine why. Because if they if they tend to vote otherwise, they may lose cases in future litigation. The result is that the judges practically end up deciding their own salaries, as wise as this may sound. And I'm referring here to two recent cases, 88 of 2013 and 127 of 2016, that ruled that salary cuts, which were austerity measures, including retroactive ones, were unconstitutional and demanded return to former standards. So basically what happened here is that this Misodikio, the court, dictated how salaries should be formed. And in this sense, they substituted the legislator. If you read those cases, there were two very strong law professor dissents. One was from my former PhD supervisor, Nikos Alivizatos, who claims, who describes how this is erroneous, because if you want to know, judges in Greece managed to become a state within a state, first of all because they managed to raise their salaries through litigation that started in the mid-90s. And when I'm saying to raise over 100% than what they were afforded by the laws. They managed to make their own appointments. If you want to know, judges in Greece, they start their career from the School of Magistrates. But then they are appointed to higher levels by judicial councils. And only in the highest level, that is in the Sibuli Epikratias, the administrative court, the Ariospa, which is civil and criminal court, and the Elektikos Synergos, which is the court of audit, only in these cases can the government intervene and propose some judges. To compare it with other states, in the U.S., Supreme Court judges are proposed by the president, and it's a very competitive procedure because there are hearings at the Senate. Everybody can watch them, and they are totally interrogated. And so, basically, there is this sense of check and balance. The judiciary power is not totally insulated from the other two. Whereas in Greece, they have managed to make their own appointments, to arrange their own salaries, to substitute the legislator, And finally, and more recently, they even want to raise their own their own retirement age.
I know you've got less than 10 minutes, and I know you've got a lot to get through, so
okay.
Perhaps you can
rationalize
some of this.
Okay, I'll just be brief in the crisis case law. Let me just say that there have been growing asymmetries in the way that courts adjudicate crisis cases. And the asymmetries have to do with the courts, different courts that have been involved. The timing of the cases, that is, courts have been more activist as the crisis deepens. Asymmetries regarding the payrolls. And asymmetries in terms of the subject of the cases, the courts have been more activist when adjudicating expenditures rather than when adjudicating revenue measures. Just keep that whole. Bunch 666 case 668 of 2012 is a seminal case that regards the constitutionality of the first MOU, and maybe I don't know where the person who asked the question is.
He's left his stuff. So. Okay. Is it ticking or he's coming back?
All right. But this case. Touches on the issue of the legal nature of the MOUs, whether they are legally binding or non-legally binding, international agreements, etc. But I'm just mentioning some examples here of crisis case law that, as I said, Greek courts have issued asymmetric decisions based on the factors I mentioned. Now, if you take the European factor into account, parties that wanted to challenge the measure in European courts, and I'm saying the Court of Justice of the EU and the European Court of Human Rights, have not been successful either. The first, because the CJEU has a tendency to decline to rule on preliminary references concerning austerity measures. They did the same in Portugal and Romania. The European Court of Human Rights recognized a wide margin of appreciation to the political branches and the national authorities. So they ruled, for example, in the Koufaki versus and Adadi versus Greece case that salary cuts were not disproportional restriction to property. And I should say that in my research, I use comparative cases from other countries like Portugal, where the Constitutional Court has been very activist on social rights issues. And Cyprus, of course, which is part of my research, where bail-in damages litigation has not been successful on a national level, but the Cypriot High Court said that you can perfectly bring your case to the civil court to ask for damages. And I should say that recent case law at the Court of Justice of the EU regarding this Cypriot bailing, which a paper of mine is coming out soon on this issue, ruled that. Basically, they were not successful on the EU level as well. And now I come to my last part, the people. The people have a lot of power. And this is the former Speaker of the Parliament on the eve of the 2015 referendum. And I chose this image because I was shocked when I saw it. And I was shocked because that night, the eve of the referendum, was rather the whole week when we only had a week to debate our referendum. Yeah. That night before the referendum, if you followed the news and if you followed social media, there was great polarization regarding the yes or the no vote. And despite this polarization, and despite the fact that one would expect state institutions to remain neutral in these crisis moments, the Speaker of the Parliament joined the No campaign and was very passionate about it. She went to Syntagma Square and started singing passionate songs. So in this frame, we can understand how this referendum took place in Greece 2 years ago. Article 44, paragraph 2, says that the referenda should happen only on crucial national matters, and fiscal matters cannot be a part of a referendum. I should also say that there is no culture of referenda in Greece since 1974. So for 40 years, in the Metapolitευση era, we have had no referendum. In 2011, the idea of a referendum by former Prime Minister George Papandreou shocked the Eurozone. That's when the Grexit talks started appearing on the public dialogue, and finally led to his resignation. Now, in 2015, there have been serious constitutional issues regarding this plebiscite. There was no time for deliberation. The question was vague and confusing, as you will see in the following slides. The subject was erroneous and misleading. It was contrary to the Council of Europe standards regarding how referenda should happen. And the most serious mistake, in my view, was that it was used as a political manipulation tool by Alexis Tsipras, our former prime minister.
Current prime minister.
Sorry. Our current...
Yes.
It was used as a manipulation tool to let the people decide what they want, and with shocking repercussions. Here, let's compare the Grexit referendum with a Brexit referendum. In the Brexit referendum, the question was rather simple. Should the United Kingdom remain a member of the EU or leave the EU? In the Grexit case, the question was, should the plan of agreement be accepted, which was submitted by the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the IMF in the Eurogroup of 25/6/2015, comprises of two parts, which constitute their unified proposal. The first is entitled Reforms for the Completion of the Current Programme and Beyond, and the second, Preliminary Debt Sustainability Analysis. No or yes? So imagine an average Greek voter going to the polls and having to decide on this issue. Even for me, who am an educated person, I do not exactly know what is the preliminary debt sustainability analysis. And most importantly, this this paper that the first paragraph refers to was a non-paper, and then it was out of the table. So in the case of Greece, Grexit was not officially pronounced. It was implied, because if the negotiations broke, then Grexit would not get more money, and you know what would follow. In the Brexit case, Brexit was officially pronounced. In the Grexit case, the government defied the popular mandate, despite the overwhelming majority of 63.4%. Alexis Tsipras a week later decided on next bailout, whereas the British government respected the mandate and is going to initiate the procedures for Article 50, etc. Also, there was no time for discussion, just a week for these crucial matters, with a very vague and misleading question. And to sum up, Just some questions that may seem rhetorical, but they're not rhetorical. I feel that what we see is the normalization of the exception. And we see that in the way that decisions are made, in the way institutions function. The question is how to restore the lost balance. I'm not sure this can happen very efficiently, and whether the Constitution will be resilient enough to sustain these shocks. And I'm not sure either whether a constitutional revision, which the present government now promotes, will solve these matters. Also, it is a chance to revisit our perceptions about sovereignty in the new age. And sovereignty for Greece, which has been a member of the EU, as I said in the beginning, since the early 1980s. But it keeps losing some parts of its sovereignty, where the power is transferred mainly to ad hoc institutions to decide which are not, sometimes not legitimate and not accountable. And the last part is the populist threat. I don't want to see Greece becoming the next Hungary or a next Poland, where the present governments have used the constitution as a facade to serve their own purposes and their own interests and to bring the state to occupation. I'm not implying anything here for the present government, but I'm saying that these are some trends that we see in Europe, and I hope not to see in Greece. I close my speech with this final slide, 50 years of change, Andreas Papandreou and Alexis Tsipras, 50 years apart. Andreas Papandreou used to say, it's only fair to ask our friends understanding on our effort to make Greece an equal member of the European Economic Community, a Greece that will prosper, advance, be free, and be liberal. And Alexis Tsipras, in January 2015, that was some days before he became a prime minister, austerity is not part of the treaties. Democracy and the principle of popular sovereignty are. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Anna. We've got plenty of time for questions, discussion, so why don't I just hand it over? We'll start with you.
I'm also a fellow Greek. I've been teaching constitutional law in this country for quite a while. So
your name?
Marinos Diamantidis. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's all good, very useful. I'd like to know a little bit more about where your PhD ended, but that's for another time. Regarding just your presentation today, I will revisit, first of all, the first point I made, which is, in my reading of that first Conseil d'Etat decision, what struck me was the judges are right. This is really not either a legal question, I mean the validity of that, or a political question. You did correct me saying that it's not an international political agreement, but more or less, what these memoranda are bureaucratic agreements appended, attached to some loan agreement, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they are. So the first thing I want to tell you is, if indeed they are sort of the printed version of the permanent exception and crisis that you talk about, then is it about looking forward restoring the balance between legal and political sovereignty? You know, sovereignty is defined by Kelsen, or as defined by whoever you want to pick up, a political constitutionalist representative, or is it the implosion of both? Okay, so if it's the implosion of both into pure management of crisis, as Agamben and other theorists talk about, then really constitutional law with and constitutional politics, have the balance between them is rather irrelevant. So that's one point. And the other one is, because I've been teaching in this country, I wouldn't want you to give the impression that Brexit referendum was any better. I mean, obviously, the Tsipras one was, you know, what it was. But Yes, and they had a year. But you know, you read the papers, you know what information these people were fed, what they voted for, why they voted Brexit whilst they were voting. So it is just as much proof of idiotic, overall the idiocy of contemporary politics as the Greek one. Perhaps the Greek one was a bit more, let's say, tzitzipot, or how can I say it? So on that note, the last point is, when you talk about constitutional facades, or rather the constitutional facade remaining now in Greece, first of all, I wouldn't want this to be, you know, Greece on the spotlight. Greece is a weird country, but most of them are. And so the facadeness of the constitution, of constitutionalism, has been perhaps exposed much too much today because of crisis, but there are people who've always said that liberal constitutional democracy is a facade for exceptionalism. At least so far as someone dictatorially decides what is the state of exception. That could be Hitler, or it could be the Bank of Greece, or the Bank of the World Bank. But, so these two points, is this the end of something wonderful, or is the uncovering of the rubbish under the carpet? And B, is the law and political sovereignty gone, replaced by pure management of crisis? So these two things to think about.
Anna, do you want to have a go at addressing those?
Yes. Regarding your second point on the Grexit versus Brexit, I'm not saying that British citizens voted rationally or whatever. My point had to do with procedure and keeping the form. I think that the procedure matters to have a balanced debate. And, you know, it's good for healthy politics, so to put it. In Greece, we did not have that. What we had was a fiasco. It was a terrible fiasco that I don't think has ever happened in any other European country. And it was a fiasco because for 40 years we had not had such incidences. But, to come to your other point... on the
bureaucracy taking management. Over from politics and law, basically.
Yeah, I think that's a more general trend. You don't see it only in Greece. Politics is becoming managerial, which is sad.
That's any managed book.
Which is about? I would love to read it.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, let's take some more questions starting here.
So financial lawyer, probably among constitutional and public lawyers.
Uh-huh. Or non-lawyers.
No, non-lawyers.
your name?
My name is Apostolos Boutsinis, and I run the global financial markets practice for Shermer Sterling, which is a big law firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I congratulate you as a young scholar in this field. It's quite interesting. You should take my comments as constructive criticism, perhaps for further research.
Mm-hmm.
Countries which have legal personality and international law borrow in the international markets and assume legal commitments which are legally valid and binding, and such legal commitments have to be respected by everybody. In the case of the Greek memoranda, I think there are two or three points that I want your commentary on in terms of how they fit into the public or constitutional law debate in Greece. The first one is the Articles of Agreement of the IMF. I think one point for further research is, as you know, the IMF is a separate several lender. All the lenders of the Hellenic Republic are not the same. You have intergovernmental loan agreements between the members of the European Union. You have the IMF. But the memorandum as a set of legal principles that is attached to the loan agreements applies equally to all the lenders. Greece adhered to the Articles of Agreement of the IMF in 1947, and that's an international treaty that has been ratified by Parliament, and Greece has been a member of the IMF. It has respected fully the Articles of Agreement, the conditionality of the IMF, and has benefited from the largest loan in the history of the IMF. The loan facilities to Greece exceed the Greek quota by 3,000%. For those of you who are not familiar with the IMF is like a self-insurance organization. Everybody's putting money in just to draw the facility, and everybody signed up to the conditions under which the IMF is lending, in 1947 and ratified in the Greek Parliament. So I don't know to what extent you have, your research has covered this point, but I would think that loans by the IMF to the Hellenic Republic, subject to conditionality, are in full compliance with the Articles of Agreement, both the initial ones of Bretton Woods and the subsequent amendment in the Conference of the Rambouillet, 1971, mm-hmm. and fully ratified under Greek law. So before I go into the ESM loans, I would like to understand, you know, how that fits into your analysis. Because I just don't agree that these are all political ideas. I mean, a lot of lawyers have spent a lot of time making sure that everything is legal, and in the end, everything is done properly. So, but I would like to understand the link between international law and constitutional law when it comes to the IMF obligations.
Okay, thank you. Do you want to answer that now, or do you want to take some more?
Let's take
maybe take one more. Angela, do you have a question to ask us?
Sure. I mean, so we've talked a lot about your research, and I find it fascinating. One suggestion on the way forward is, I'm not sure if you should actually approach Greece as an exception. It seems to me, you know, Greece is coming back as, you know, been an exception, been a crisis-prone country. I think there are a couple of, you know, political science concepts you may want to consider. I mean, mm-hmm. it seems to me that Greece faces, first of all, you know, what Roddy has called, like, you know, the dilemma between economic integration, national sovereignty, and democratic politics. And, you know, you may take these kind of crisis moments or crisis periods and see how cultures essentially solve this dilemma from a legal perspective. The second one is the concept of policy change in political science. I mean, it seems to me that crisis of that sort, exogenous economic crisis, kind of push countries towards, you know, changes of their equilibrium. So if the constitution is a punctuated equilibrium, exogenous crisis essentially lead them to a new equilibrium. So maybe if you, you know, take cases of that sort from different economic crises or, you know, different mm-hmm. crisis moments in general, it would provide, you know, a comparative framework, and you can see, like, Greece is not so much an exception, but it's actually a variation of this kind of models.
Mm-hmm. You've got two big things to deal with.
Let me answer to Angelos first, and then I'll come to Mr. Boudzinis. Regarding the second point, I am using some literature from Latin America, where we've seen not exactly constitutional change, but change in some sense. And regarding the crisis moment, sorry, could you please clarify that? Because
so, if you assume that, you know, every crisis moment is viewed by the states, at least, you know, states in the global, in the OECD world, and kind of in the liberal market economy, if crises are more or less viewed inside the dilemma of national sovereignty, economic integration, and democratic politics, you know, essentially it seems to me the whole idea of the institutional crisis and legal crisis is how to solve this dilemma, like what to choose out of it. So if you know, kind of gather crisis moments of that sort, you may have a comparative framework of how these crises were solved inside this dilemma.
I see what you mean. Mm-hmm. Thank you for this. To come to Mr. Boudzinis, thank you for this point. I'm not an international law expert, but maybe, yes, you're right. The thing is that the nature of the MOUs has been disputed, and not just in the Greek courts. It has been disputed in European courts, if you're aware. I would love to read more about this topic that you raise. Yes, but maybe we could discuss about it more later.
It's fascinating.
Yes,
I know it's going to be disputed. I don't know why, still. the other point is, again, which is...
Can I just take some other questions and come back to you? Because I've got at least five people who want to ask a question, and I'm sure you'll have a second go, but I need to be fair about this. So...
One of your slides was the very disturbing photograph of the former Speaker of the Greek Parliament.
Yeah.
Not me.
Populism made flesh, as it were. One of the things which she headed was the so-called Truth Commission. And there the argument was made that there are, I guess the implication was that there are inalienable rights which are independent of economic circumstance or condition. In other words, the human rights of Greeks have been produced by the bailout provisions, and that somehow these rights are independent of economic circumstance and the economic cycle, etc. Now, that seemed to be based, and she is legally trained.
Yeah.
That seemed to be based on a notion of legal philosophy, which went well beyond your point about Kelsen or others, and the notion of sovereignty. And I guess it was, and this is, I suppose, part of the question, has no grounding in the legal philosophy of the Greek state. It seems to be something which is, I'm not quite sure where it comes from, but it seems to be a normative argument, not a legal argument. But I just wonder if there is a legal grounding that somehow I was missing.
The inalienable rights.
Yeah.
My perception of rights and law is more practical, I should state, because rights are adjudicated.
Rights are adjudicated.
So there's a lot of talk about rights and a lot of books and a lot of philosophy about rights, but at the end of the day, it is the courts that decide on the rights. They have the final word, right? Perhaps you could agree.
Well, in one of your cases, the judges have to interpret the constitutional clause that talk about the responsibility of the Greek state to provide for the dignity of the Greek people. And whereas in previous cases the dignity of the Greek people meant X, now it meant bare survival. So if you can live with €400 a month, that covers, that ticks the obligation of dignity. So, of course, it's... But I think Mrs. What's her name? Constantopoulou?
Mm-hmm.
Was not thinking, is not thinking as a lawyer. In fact, now she's heading a political party for Rome.
Mm.
So, normative or legal, I would say...
You're saying there is a provision in the Constitution to say...
To say that they have to give them a dignified
yes.
life. Yes. So that was a debate. Yeah.
And that's the ultimate core. And I should mention something else. When such cases went to the European Court of Human Rights, like the Koufaki case... she was Mrs. Koufaki and the other V, which is the Public Servants Association, were claiming that the fact that their salary went from €2,000 to €1,800 was a breach of their right to property. And imagine, this court is composed by judges that come from 47 different member states, including from the eastern, from eastern countries, where salaries can be as high as €500. So what is constitutional, what is proportional, it all has to do with the legal background, our education, and where we come from. So, yes, we should take that in mind in terms of what factors influence judicial decisions.
Ilya,
yeah,
introduce yourself as well, please.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1974, when I was a first year student at the University of Athens, a rather enlightened law professor gave us, the entire class, an article by Adamantios Papalassis, which was published in the Journal of Law and Economics in 1959, and the title was "The Impediments of the Greek the Greek legal system as an impediment to economic growth." And that, of course, was drawing on the experience of the 1950s. Now, what you have presented here actually brings to memory what Adamantios Papalassis describes back in 1959 of what was happening in the 1950s. And my question to you as a student of the legal system in Greece, is to what extent the legal system in Greece was an impediment, or is still an impediment, to decision making, to exiting the crisis, for creating, fostering the crisis, and so on. Can you enlighten us, please?
How's the legal system?
Yes, I mean, obviously, what you described here is basically, I can send you the paper, is what the manuscript last described in 1951.
The legal system, you mean as a whole, as
institutional arrangements, judges, you know,
process,
the processes, you know, the disregard to parliament, you know, but by legal I mean, you know, the entire constitutional apparatus that is used to create law and obligations.
Mm-hmm. I have the view that it is the people that make the institutions, and not vice versa. So all judges were doing their job properly and interpreting the constitution as they should, then the world would be a better place. And if the MPs were doing their job properly, goes on and on. I think that the constitution of Greece, as it is now, has serious flaws. One of it being that it's too long. It's has a lot of words. It should be shorter and not contain too many details. But on the whole, I think that it is a rather good constitution. The problem is the people that embody the institutions of a state.
So, you know, I mean, the answer is that people have not changed in the 50s. So
the people that tried the system.
First of all, there has been a new constitution since the 50s.
Problem size.
Yeah. Nothing has changed. Plus ça change. Okay, let's take a couple more questions.
Hi, Bella from So I think what you're doing is really ambitious and very, very interesting. It's ambitious because it's interdisciplinary. You're dealing with topics that are in constitutional law, but also in politics, and you're presented in a mixed audience, and that's why you're getting so difficult questions, because not many people try to do that. So I think we have to congratulate it. And to make it even more difficult, you're touching upon different parts of the law. So you're discussing constitutional law, and as we've seen, there are aspects of the international law that we should look at. And I think, and I'm afraid I'm coming to my question also of European law, and I'm not a lawyer, European lawyer, I'm doing public policy, but the way you discuss the relationship of the EU with Greece in this presentation, looked to me that it needs a little bit more depth. So like, for example, you describe the European Union as an external player, while in public policy we would see them as an internal player, since the state is formally represented there, the Greek state, as any other state, is formally represented. So we consider it as an internal player, which means that, you know, the argument changes a little bit. So I would just, say one more thing to do is look a little bit more at the relationship with the EU at political terms, but also European law, which is probably easier for you to reach. I don't know what kind of literature you're using. If you get into the policy change literature that the other colleagues mentioned, if you are combining politics and law in the book that you're writing. So one more thing to do.
Thank you, Stella. Vasilis and Julia. Vasilis.
Thanks, Vasilis. Anna, I cannot get my head around whether the argument that you make goes relates to the form and the procedure of these things, or instead to the substance. And just to give you two examples, when you're talking about the decrees, you're saying we do overuse, and especially more recently. The truth is that the decrees are provided in the Constitution, mm-hmm. and they do go to Parliament within 40 days, and are being voted for. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So the procedure is being kept in substantive terms, we know this is not what the constitution meant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then when you went to the Greek referendum, you said, well, you know, the procedure was not followed. Actually, the procedure was followed, and the referendum was whether the public wanted to support a particular agreement. The public didn't want to support a particular agreement. Within a week later, the Prime Minister successfully brought another package. Yeah? So, you know, so either you worry about the procedure was followed in the referendum, yeah? Sorry, the procedure was followed in the other, or you care about the substance. And it wasn't very clear to me whether the problem is, it seems that in different cases, you know, there was a complaint about substance here and a complaint about procedure from the, mm-hmm. and I don't know whether you need both in order to go, you know, to take forward your argument, or there's some sort of inconsistency there.
Okay, can mm-hmm. I take another question as well? Because we're running out of time and I want to collect them. Just identify yourself, please. Yeah.
Sure. I am Georgia Papalandou, and I'm a student here at the LSE. I'm doing a master's in law. And I would like to ask your opinion about whether you think that the quotes of the courts in Greece were presented with an undue burden having to decide the constitutionality of the memoranda. Because these are questions that are, you know, in their essence, they're political questions, and courts are supposed to exercise only marginal control over the executive. So I want to know what you think about if it was, like, fair for a judge to be presented with such a question. And a second question.
Well, one question, please. Yeah, 'cause I've got three more people who want to ask a question.
Okay.
I've got
okay.
less than 10 yeah. minutes, so.
Okay, I'm glad that I could provoke so many questions.
But you need to give answers as well.
Yes. Okay, let me start with the last one. I don't think it's an undue burden. I mean, that's their role in a rule of law. The courts are entitled to exercise review of constitutionality. Now, the question is how they do it. Well, that depends on the cases and the timing, and as I said, and many other factors, but... on principle, yes, they do have the duty to do that. To go back to Vasilis's question, the form of the substance, I think I care about both. And I care about both because, as I said, change may happen in ways that, for example, you may keep the facade. You may say that Article 70, Article 44 gives me the right to issue legislative decrees, but when you do this extensively and repeatedly, that becomes a problem for a state. You're basically abusing the constitution. As regards the referendum, it was the procedure was followed, but not entirely. I mean, for example, as I said, the Council of Europe standards were not followed, and basically the Council of State ruled that was perfectly fine when they tried to challenge the decree on which the referendum was based. I think that there were serious issues of constitutionality there. For example, the 1 week of deliberation. The law provides for a maximum of 30 days, if I'm not mistaken, maybe you know. But at any case, the practice is not that you announce a referendum a week before it happens. So yes, to answer your question, I think that change can happen in both ways, and I'm interested in both form and substance.
Okay, I think I've got two or three people. I'm going to take them all together and then
okay.
you can answer them.
Sure.
Aguilar.
Right. Yeah, very interesting talk, and I think most of us, it speaks to a lot of us in here, so it covers issues, law, EU politics, international relations, concerns of sovereignty. It's very interesting. I have a question. So if I understand correctly, what you're basically presenting is an idea that under very close European EU scrutiny, basically you have a process of institutional erosion in Greece, so or procedural erosion in any case. And I find that interesting because the Greek constitution has basically co-living with the EU, cohabitating with the EU for almost as long as it has existed. And it's not like Greek institutions were robust, and processes were robust before the crisis happened.
Right.
So you basically have a case of a country that presumably under an influence that was supposed to be benevolent, lead to a better state, to kind of more robust processes. You actually have a cohabitation that basically leads to actually more erosion. So basically my question is, it's not a very scientific, academic question, but is the EU not as good an influence as it was advertised to be, or is something fundamentally wrong about the Greek legal system that makes it unsuitable for the times we live in, I suppose?
It's not fit for purpose.
Natalia Magiolou, visiting fellow at the Hellenic Conservatory. Maybe my question relates a little bit to that of Angelus. It has to do with sovereignty. It seems to be something that is not only a question in Greece, especially after the crisis, but it seems to be the main question also in France in the elections, in the US. So in Brexit, it seems to be something that different societies worry about, the erosion of the state. And Marc Abelès, who is a political anthropologist, has been reading this book, Beyond the State. So coming from a French, where the state is supposed to be a very robust institution, this is speaking of globalization. Is Greece an exception? And could we talk about national sovereignty in contemporary world with globalization, but also when huge debts are discussed, and not only in Greece, but also in other contexts?
Thank you. I'll make a little very short.
Very, very short.
Assuming it all matters, the memorandum, as you know, rather the laws the Greek Parliament passes to endorse them, fall short of international law labor standards. And the oxymoron, of course, is that the Greek constitution says that international agreements by Greece are superior to local legislation. So therefore, by endorsing their memoranda, they go against the constitution, which says that they should uphold first the international obligations in labor law. And you could read Emilios Christodoulidis on this. He's in Glasgow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
Okay.
Okay.
You have a question about the relationship, essentially, between the EU and member states and
Stella Lavi?
Stella Lavi was a comment. Angelus' question.
Okay, let's start with Angelus. Yeah, the EU has an influence, a positive or a negative. You mean in relation to Greece as a state and as a legal system?
Yeah. So is the EU a positive or negative influence, or is Greece such a mess that even if you give it a positive influence, it turns into a negative? That's basically
the I think, thank you for this question. I think it's a positive influence, and my only concern is that this influence had to be. And now you're talking for the EU or for the Troika?
The EU
influence.
Yeah, let's keep it at the EU.
No, I think it's a positive influence. It has been a positive influence in terms of. Legislation and, of course, in terms of the judicial acquis that we have acquired. Now, whether it could be applied to a failed state, that's hard. I think Greece needs to reform, but this cannot happen within the time limits set by our creditors. I think this needs a long-term adjustment, and it basically needs people's willingness to change, I think. Now, on the question of sovereignty, As I said in the beginning of my talk, we live in an age of shared sovereignty. So not any state is totally independent and totally autonomous, especially when you think about European states that are part of this EU. Now, as regards to the indebted states, yes, of course, they lose a significant part of the sovereignty, but that's a trade-off. I mean, if they want, they can go bankrupt. Or we've seen, we've seen very bad cases. We don't want to see Greece turning into a Latin American country.
It's too late.
Yeah, maybe it's too late.
Okay, before we thank Anna, let me just remind you that we have one final such engagement before the end of term. In fact, this is the last research seminar of the academic year on Tuesday, the 21st of March, in 2 weeks' time from today, at 6 p.m., we have Professor Stathis Kalivas from Yale University, who will be speaking on the subject of reflections on the punctuated equilibrium theory of modern Greek history. It's on the 21st of March at 6 p.m. in Clement House, room 602. I hope to see you there. Please join me in thanking Anna for this evening's